This is the third interview with Ernestine Kettler on February 7, 1973. This interview was to cover the period that she spent in Seattle and her involvement with the IWW there. On this day, however, the interviewee seemed to have more severe memory problems than on past occasions. She even had difficulty remembering certain words, which did not happen in past interviews or informal discussions. Much of the material covered here should probably be covered once again in the final interview with her, where various things will be picked up. The interview began with a discussion of her radical contacts and experiences in New York, and also of the women with whom she had been involved in Washington, D.C. I showed her Doris Stevens' appendix in her book, in which she listed the various women who had been arrested. She went through the list and uses as a way to jog her memory and discussed those women that she did remember and attempt to pin down those who were in the group of four with her. After this, we moved into a discussion of the Seattle period and her involvement with the IWW. This focused primarily on her marriage to Emerson and the experiences with the police who were after Emerson. There seems to be a fair amount of confusion about these experiences also. At one point, she talks about his being in jail, and in another she talks about his jumping bail and their hiding for a year. Much of this should be covered again. She was basically rather reluctant to discuss the personal aspects of her experience, and so it was difficult to get too clear a picture.
Of another period?
No, see, they claim, that's what I wanted to ask you about.
You see, this... you know, I'm awfully confused about Lucy Burns. There was one red-headed woman in there, and I always thought of her as Lucy Burns, and I used to see her every now and then in New York after the arrest. And she was one of the women at the workhouse when we were arrested, when we got there. But it seems to me that Lucy Burns was a young woman, but she seems to be of an older generation than we were.
She, I believe, is probably Alice Paul's age, so she would be about 10 years older than you.
Is there a...
See, they mentioned...
Well, let's see.
In fact, I wanted to clarify to see if you remembered. There were a couple of things in there. They said that she seemed... Lucy Burns is the one to whom they attributed the whole business about bringing up the political prisoners. And then she seemed...
Well, you see, she was arrested in September 1917. But, you know, as I say, as soon as a contingent was arrested, another one took its place. So there is no date in September,
right.
No date. And she was, I know that Lucy Burns was in the prison.
Right.
And we got there.
See, because she, in that letter...
Because during the time that we were there, no other women had been arrested.
See, in that letter, they say, all of you that signed the letter say, that it sounds like she was the one who was in the... separated from the rest of you, because it says that she should be rejoined with you. It sounded like she was put in the psychopathic ward. And now Peggy John... Do you think it was her rather than Peggy John?
I think they made
John?
A mistake.
Okay.
Well, absolutely, because during September, Peggy was there, and she was in the hospital all of that time. And it's possible that they had forgotten it,
Now, was she one of the people who signed that letter? I don't think so. Peggy
Jones. No, sure, her name is not here. That's the reason I question it. And I'm trying to see what they say about, let's see what they say about Peggy Johns. Well, now, you see, I don't remember her being in jail twice. I don't see how they there could be such a discrepancy in months, because we were certainly there together.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what they say about Winslow.
You think she's the one that was with you?
Yeah. But they've got a different date for her, October 15th, 1917, sentenced to 7 months in the district. In district jail for picketing. And I wish I could remember this other woman's name. And I would if I went through all of these names.
Oh, okay.
And that is, I think so, you know.
Okay. Well, but you
she
don't
came from Wyoming. She was a lawyer and came from Wyoming. She certainly was born in Poland, brought to this country. My child began work at 11 in Philadelphia. For many years worked in hosiery factory in Pittsburgh. Later employed in shop in Philadelphia. Recently has won success as an actress. So you see, I'm lost. I'd have to go through all of them.
Okay. Do you recall?
Yes, I remember Adams, Pauline Adams.
Do you recall Lucy Burns being there at all? They talked about.
Well, as I say, that Lucy Burns has been on my mind for years, you know. But every now and then they talk about her as though she had preceded me by many years.
Oh, yeah.
And was not alive at that time.
No, she sometimes,
or was an old woman at that time.
I do not recall that. I think she probably would have been just 10 years older.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other thing they say in there that I wanted to ask you about, you were all in the dormitory together, you said.
Yes, we were all in the
dormitory. Because in the letter, somewhere, she mentions maybe, that you weren't in communication with each other, that was one of the demands the store Stevens.
That we weren't in communication. We certainly were. Even in this letter, in this, what would you call it? We were in that workroom every day.
But were you in the same
room? We were sitting at a long table doing nothing but talking. Well, of course, I don't remember about the talking. That might not have been permitted. But we did a lot of things that were not permitted. And then we had our constitutional outside on the grounds.
And that was together.
And it was all together with matrons. Yeah.
And we certainly
were not out of communication with each other. And we all slept in one long dormitory with beds on both sides, like the ones that you see in motion pictures, you know, in a prison bedroom,
mm-hmm.
prison ward,
in hospital
wards, you know, they had beds on both sides.
And all the suffragists were in the same dormitory, most of them.
What?
All of you who were arrested were in the same, you weren't in separate dormitories.
So. No, we're not, no, we were, they had a dormitory for about, I'd say 30 women, and I think we all slept there, and that is not only just the suffragettes, but the other women. I don't think they had two dormitories that I recall. At least I've never seen the other one. I have no recollection of seeing another dormitory. And beds were about 3 feet apart.
Were they bunk beds?
No, just straight, narrow beds. like the hospital beds or the prison beds as you see in dormitories, or like the dormitories in the army that I've seen, that is in pictures. So, this happened afterwards. We ask that we no longer be segregated and confined under locks and bars, small groups. You see, after our, insistence, we're political prisoners, and the fact that we started the brutality there, the later prisoners were segregated. They were put in cells. And this is what they're referring to. They're not referring to the time that I was there, but to the later time, see?
So you think you may have signed that after you were out then?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I'm quite sure of that. I don't think that we even wrote anything during that period.
Oh, okay. See? That's what I wanted to clarify.
I think that we merely voiced it orally.
Mm-hmm. And then after,
because we were not segregated. I know that. We asked to be confined under locks and bars in small groups. Now, you see, Lucy Burns was in there twice. And in the time that I was there, none of us were segregated. And no one was in solitary confinement, except by the voluntary one of Peggy Johns, you know, mm-hmm. who really took herself to the hospital and stayed there.
So this was probably written...
We ask exemption from prison work, that our legal right to consult counsel be recognized, to have food sent to us from outside, to supply ourselves with writing material for as much correspondence as we may need, which we didn't get. You know, we got some... We were allowed, I don't know how much correspondence, not much. I was limited to receive books, letters, newspapers, our relatives and friends. To my knowledge, I was the only one who was permitted a visitor. My mother was permitted to come and see me. And the people in the office were mad as hell because we spoke in Romanian and nobody knew. Oh, God. I'm beginning to sneeze. First, because on entering the workhouse, we found conditions very bad, that before we could ask that the suffragists be treated as political prisoners, it was necessary to make a stand for the ordinary rights of human beings for all inmates. But that must have been done before we came there, because, as I said, there were about a dozen women already there when we arrived.
But so you don't remember any statement being written inside that this was probably...
I don't remember a statement that we wrote inside. It seems to me I should remember it, but I don't remember any statement. I know what we told the superintendent virtually every day that we were there. But I don't remember. I don't remember. The written statement, I think, was done afterwards. Okay. And then they got the names of everyone who was there, but they didn't get enough names. Hilda Blumberg, let me see what that was. She was the one. She went back. She was arrested September 19th. One of the youngest prisoners, educated and taught school in this country. She had to be 21. And they should have said the same thing about me. They didn't have much history on me. They didn't ask me. I don't remember.
Mm-hmm. So you think she was one of the four?
Yeah, I think she was. She was the woman from, the girl from New York. So she was arrested September 1917. Let me finish it. I remember her.
As being already inside, maybe.
Yeah, but I know the name is familiar. And her mother, yeah. She was sentenced to 60 days, so it must have been at another, she wasn't in my group.
The entire group got the same sentence, the four of you.
What is that?
The four of you got the exact same sentences. You all got 30 days, no one got 4.
Yes, but she got 60 days, Mary Windsor. Arrested September 1917. So there must have been other sentences during that month. It's all I can figure. Because the four of us got 30 days apiece and no less, no more. I knew that a trade unionist was in our group from New York.
And that was at Hilda Bloomberg?
And Hilda Bloomberg, yeah. Or Bloomberg. Asked how old I was, he looked at me very belligerently as though he didn't want to believe me. But he knew that one thing that the suffrage party insisted on, that we were all have reached our majority. Maud Malone is the one that I'm thinking of, not Lucy Burns. Maud Malone had red hair.
And she was the older woman?
Well, she was older than I was. Librarian, lifelong suffragette. Arrested for picketing September 4th, 1917, and served sentences of 60 days. We were all released at the same time. Even those who had more time to serve, all of us were sent back.
You were all together, you were sent back?
We were all released, all of us. Well, wait a minute. No, we weren't. You know, I was so sure that we were all released. No, I don't remember. I know we were sent back to the city jail to finish our sentence after Peggy Johns was taken to Washington. And we had about 3 days more, you know, to serve. We lost our 5 days off for good behavior the first day we were in the city jail. And of course we lost it at the prison too, at the workhouse, because we initiated that
work strike.
Hmm?
Oh, the work strike?
Well, I guess you could call that the work strike, yeah. I think only four of us were released. I don't know, Judge. And we were sent to the city jail, and we raised cane in the time room. We even broke a window, and those windows are very hard to break. They were so glad to get rid of us, you can't imagine. And we disrupted the entire jail. Well, let's see, Maud Malone is the one that I mean. And Pauline Adams, she was already there. September 4th, you see, they were the women, the girls, really. They were young women then who received 60 days. How about Alice Paul? It just seemed to me she was there, but I wouldn't swear to it.
I think they say November.
Alice Paul. Oh, she was arrested a number of times. October 1919, she was arrested before the combination of women who were arrested at the time that I was arrested, who were already at the Occoquan prison at the time that I went there and afterwards. but they received very severe treatments afterwards. They were beaten, dragged across the, I don't know what you'd call it. We call it patio today, or we don't drive the driveway or something, from the office to the cells. Some women had broken ribs and were bleeding profusely and weren't treated. Others had all kinds of lacerations.
No, but that was after your group.
But that was after mm-hmm. my group. So the only thing that we got was that beating in the office. Jail sentences. I don't know, she was so sick from the food. Arrested picketing August 1917, sentenced to 60 days, so she was there when... But that's not all the women. Was, I'd have to read it.
No,
all
so
of
she
them.
Was the fourth woman, was the lawyer from Wyoming.
She was the fourth woman, yeah. And that's all I remember, is that she was a lawyer from
okay, Wyoming. That won't be too hard to find then.
But as I say, you know, some of these names, so these people, I guess, were in there. But it was Maud Malone that I kept thinking about, another Irish girl. Want me to look through these names?
About your association with Hippolyte Havel.
Well, I met him in Provincetown in 1916 when I went there, the time that I met Eugene O'Neill and a number of other people, Louise Bryan, Jack Reed, Max Eastman, Mary Heaton Vorse. Well, there are a number of, there must have been about a dozen people that I met who were either writers or artists. I think I even met one actress, but I think that was Max Eastman, Crystal Eastman, Max Eastman's sister. I think she was the actress. And but I must have known Hippolyte in New York before, by the time I came to Provincetown, I had already known him. But you see, I'm not sure of dates, you know. I'm not sure whether I met him at Provincetown, but I must have met him before then, because I wrote my first long story, and I took it to him to read, and he said it was very beautiful, but very unpublishable. And he was not the only one who read it. Eugene O'Neill read it. And they both thought I had talent, you know. As a matter of fact, I was told I had talent before then by a dramatic critic in Boston who, I don't know, I suppose they're always looking for young geniuses, you know. And what he had read was a play that I had written. And as I recall, it was a very bloody play, but he said it had the markings, you know, of a near genius.
When did you start writing?
When did I stop writing?
When did you start writing?
Oh, I was, I think, about 14. I started late, you know. I had never thought about writing, but I told you before that we thought of putting out a bulletin of some kind and the block where I lived, and the only one who wrote, I was the only one who started writing because we were going to publish our stuff. So immediately I got busy and wrote a couple of poems and wrote a long Edgar Allan Poe story, you know, of all things. I think I still have that story. And they thought it was remarkable. And you know, I mean, the way I wrote, I was just simply... I was just in another planet, in another world, you know. And I wrote it so rapidly and without any effort. And how I wrote it, I don't know. I mean, it seemed to me that I wrote it without effort, but perhaps not. You know? So when it turned out that there were only two things to publish, and my story was too long. We gave it up.
Did you have any thought about trying to become a writer then?
Oh, yes. I had a thought all my life. That's why I say that I should have gone to school and learned the craftsmanship of writing, and that would have changed my whole life.
Did you keep it up, for instance, when you were in Seattle? Were you still writing?
I'm still writing, but actually I'm writing, well, what I write now are articles, but I'm still writing. I read something, and after I finish, I immediately write a postscript to it, a long postscript, but it's a postscript, really.
I
don't publish, you see. I mean, I write, I'm not satisfied with them. Mm-hmm. I collect them, and then I get very disgusted after I get so many papers started and unfinished. I tear them up and throw them away, and some of them are quite good. But this way, I am impatient at my own inability to form sentences and ideas in a special way, and yet this is precisely what I do. I form sentences and ideas in a special way, and they're good, but they don't seem to be good to me. They're good to others, but not to me.
What did you when you showed it?
No, I really had a talent in writing, and I had a great deal to say, because I had ideas, Now, for instance, I know a young boy, I've known him since he was born, and he has quite a talent for a number of things. Writing is one of them, although I've never read anything of his. I've read certain lyrics that he composed, which I thought were quite good, and knowing him, I knew that his writing would be good, but he has no ideas. Mm-hmm. See, he's unable to really experience analysis of people and situations, and a self-analysis, and he can't get down to what is he going to write about. See? I mean, he has to consider the theme without the characterization, and I can't do that. To me, the character is the important thing.
Well, when you showed it to Hippolyte Havel, was it with an eye towards maybe his publisher? He was putting out a paper then.
No. Yes, he was. I think he still was. I don't know when he quit it, but it seemed to me he was always running around looking for paper and string to tie the papers and perhaps for money for postage to mail them. And I think altogether I knew him about until I came west, to mm-hmm. about 1918. And that's about 2 years or 2.5 years at the most. And of course, although I saw him quite a bit in Provincetown, I don't remember the situations. No remembered situations. But I did see quite a bit of him in New York. And as I said, he used to invite me to dinner, and sometimes he had money, and when he didn't, he'd send me around to get some money. People would take me to the Brevoort Hotel. I don't know what they would have done to him if he hadn't been able to get any money, but nobody would allow the proprietors to kick him out or force him in the kitchen to wash dishes. So they always gave him money, besides which they knew him.
Well, what was the nature of your relationship? He was quite a bit older than you, wasn't he, at that time?
Oh, yes. He must have been about 50, because he died about 20 years ago. He might have been younger, but he was between 40 and 50. And I was just like a daughter, In fact, I was like a little puppy. He called me Keo, which I think is the name of a puppy he once had. Oh. And I don't know where the pictures are. I still have that letter of his, but it's of no account. I don't even remember what was in it. And I think he wrote it in Provincetown. I kept certain letters, but I tore a lot of my things up. I tore a lot of papers, a lot of letters up. When you have nobody to leave things to, you wonder, what on earth am I keeping them for? Or who's going to do anything with them? But I kept a lot of letters. I still have some letters from famous people, so more or less, But everything's packed up, like those pictures that I said I'd go through. They're packed up. Now, there might be in that carton down there that I have underneath that table, or there might be over at the Socialist Party where I took out two cartons carted over there.
Well, maybe...
I'm trying to remember, even if I have...
Well, first, when you went to Everett was like 2 years after the Everett Massacre or so.
Well, that was
in 1916.
Oh, yes, yes.
Now, what was the atmosphere there like? Was there still a lot of...
Well, there were a lot of socialists, but... and there were a lot of IWWs. Now, all I know is I don't particularly recall anything special in Everett, but there were an awful lot of IWWs in Everett throughout that whole northwest country, in Washington and in Oregon. And I knew a lot of them. I was socially affiliated with them.
Now, was that your first contact with the IWWs?
No, I met them in New York. No, I met them in New York. You know, as I said, my contact was with anarchists, wobblies, and socialists. And that's from my earliest recollection. And then, as I said, my earliest recollection was with the Socialist Party around the corner from where I lived in New York.
What was the atmosphere in the town like after that? I mean, even 2 years later, was there any remnants of feeling about?
I don't remember.
Now, why?
You see, I was living with a socialist family, and then the only people I met were socialists in Everett, but in Seattle, Washington, I met a lot of wobblers.
Now, when you were in Everett, I wasn't clear. You were working?
Well, I had a public stenography business.
So you had your own business?
Yeah. I didn't do very well with it.
What, did they set you up in an office or something?
They did, yeah. You know, Catherine Hodgins set me up in an office and everything, typewriter, paper, and so on and so forth. And, I don't know, I think I managed to pay the rent in that office. But I don't think that I really made any money. I was not qualified, really. You don't have that on, have you?
Yeah, it's on.
Oh, it is? Oh. I was not qualified either as a typist or as a stenographer. I didn't finish my courses, and I hadn't really worked. You know, I'd been going to school, and except, as I said, before going down to Washington, I worked in Brunswick, New Jersey for a defense industry. And then I came west. See, it's difficult to give you the exact periods, you see.
Well,
whether it was after or before or what year or what month, I don't remember. I do remember that it was in 17 that I went to Washington and spent the 30 days in jail. But it was also in 17 that I worked in that Brunswick office.
That was probably earlier.
It was either earlier or afterwards, or it might have been in 19. Now, I remember, I just have a recollection that I went west. I went to Everett in April. So that must have been April 1918, a few months before the armistice was signed. And when was that flu epidemic? Do you?
That was 1918. I'm not sure the exact month.
Yeah. And that was in that flu epidemic. A lot of things happened in 1918.
Now, did you leave Everett because the business was not doing well?
Well, yes, I wasn't making any money, and I was living off of the Hodges's. And I didn't like that very well. And also, a friend of Catherine's came to Everett, who knew her, and suggested that if I come to Seattle, he might be able to get me a job. He was a secretary in one of the AFL unions. So I did so. And I got a job. It was, as I recall, in the Electrical Office Workers Union. But again, my inexperience was a barrier, you know. I couldn't, just as I was getting used to the work, you know, he thought that he couldn't keep me. So that was the end of my work. I don't know how long I worked there. I'm mentioning these things because they were a part of my experience, really. And also why I went to Seattle. But shortly after I arrived there, I met a quite a large group, and I don't know through whom I met them. And they were the radical elite. They were the anarchists and the socialists and the radicals without any affiliation.
They weren't affiliated with the Wobblies?
Not the Wobblies at that time. I met them later, but still through them, you know. I would meet a Wobbly or two through them. And also I was interested, you know. I had no problem finding their headquarters and going there, and I went there for a long time. I think for all the time that I was in Seattle, I used to go to the headquarters for their meetings and their forums and socials, and they had quite a few of them, too.
Now, what did this group of people, this was before you went to the Wobblies, and what was this group of people, where would they meet? Were they connected with the Labor Temple there, or what?
No, they weren't. I entered the Labor Temple through my job as in the Electrical Workers Union, and I used to go every week. You know, it was just, you know, it was a fascinating experience for me, and they had a the balcony was set aside for outsiders, for those who are not members or not delegates, or were just merely members. I was a member of the union, of the Office Employees Union at that time. I think they called that the Bookkeepers Union. And so I used to go quite often, and I knew what was going on in the labor movement through my interest in the Labor Temple, and also through my interest with other union members that I met, not only in the Labor Temple, but also in the office where I worked. But the group that I discovered were really, dilettantes, you might say, insofar as activity is concerned. They were intellectuals. Some, a few of them were professors or teachers, and some were accountants, and they had some professional standing. And, of course, the most interesting person was one they called Heine Abrams. Heine Abrams was quite a character in Seattle. He was a homosexual, but he was also a political person with perhaps all the knowledge, machinations and chicaneries of political life. He used to say that he was born too late. He should have been born much, much sooner during to be a buffoon in the court of some king or other, you know. But it was an interesting group, and it was educational for me.
Was it primarily as an intellectual discussion
group? Well, it was an intellectual group. It was not a... Oh, they discussed politics, of course, but they discussed it from a different viewpoint. The Wobblies discussed it from the viewpoint of industrial work, you know, and they were very limited in their political views, and also they were very much against what they called politics, because their only knowledge of politics was capitalist politics. You know. Couldn't understand political policies being a part of their own organization, couldn't see it. To them it was all economic, they were all economic policies. They were very backward in that regard, and it's one reason that I didn't really stay with the IWW, or that I joined them only for a short time, because to me they simply weren't offering me anything educationally or intellectually.
So your intellectual, political affiliation at this point was with this mixed group of
people. Was with a mixed group
of
people.
And they weren't really...
Not only that, but they were with a mixed group of people for all of my life. Mm-hmm. You know.
Now, were there many women in this group?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Was feminism talked about at all in that group?
Well, I imagine so. You know, as I said, you know, I discussed it all my life, and we always discussed... We discussed various issues, and I'm sure that feminism was one of the issues we discussed. And but the men either found it not practical to denigrate us, or else were in agreement with us. I don't remember. There were no arguments that I recall. I cannot recall arguments on feminism. But there were no very profound discussions on it. I think it was just taken for granted, you know. And also the issue then was suffrage, mm-hmm. not full emancipation. To me, I considered full emancipation as a part of my entire philosophical struggle against discrimination. You know? And so that, you know, whatever... discrimination existed, I opposed it. And there wouldn't be any special part, any specific part more than another that I would oppose. Except, of course, we were in the First World War, and I was opposed to that. And I was opposed to police brutality, because there was a great deal of it at that time. And even I experienced it wasn't police brutality, but boy, when you get a pat on your shoulder and you turn around and see a policeman, this is a chief who wants to see you, you feel like you're in the mafia.
Now, I wanted to ask you, was that incident was before you were married, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, that was before. Okay. Everything that I'm telling you now is really before I was married.
Well, at this time, what was your attitude about marriage and free love and all of the things that these
Well,
people
I was pretty anarchistic about that. You know. I had no... I wanted to get married like anybody else. I thought that it would be... that I needed stability more than anything else. And I wasn't a moralistic person in that sense. You know. I believed in free love, but I didn't believe in we have no discrimination.
Promiscuity.
I didn't believe in promiscuity, but I certainly believed in free love, and I believed in trial marriages, because you just never know how a marriage is going to work out if you don't first live with a person. And then marriage and divorce are not easy decisions to make.
But you felt ultimately you would get married.
Well, I don't know whether I felt ultimately. I felt ultimately I'd get married because that was the thing to do, you know. And it certainly was in contradiction to my free love ideas, you know.
Now, were you living with any men at this time?
No,
at least
no, I wasn't, no. And, let me see. Did I tell you the story about when I was asked to go up to see this police chief?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, then it's no sense repeating that.
No, that was fine.
Yeah, he thought, first of all, I was an Ernestine mm-hmm. Evans. And then I was, I had a friend, a German, and they were put in. Weren't they placed in some kind of concentration camps?
There was an attempt to deport people.
Or put them in concentration camps if they were here. They wouldn't deport them, neither during the First World War or the Second World War.
Well, there was a roundup. This was after the war. Towards the end of the war, there was a roundup of radical.
Well, yes, that was during the
that
was the 1919 roundup of radicals when Van de Veer became their lawyer, and before then he wrote that I'm not in very good form today because I can't remember that law that he wrote, the against radicals.
The Sedition Act?
The Sedition Act. He wrote it. And he said, by God, if I can write it, I can unwrite it. So he took the cases of all those wobblies who were arrested, including some socialists. I don't know whether he took Eugene P. Debs' case.
No, I don't remember.
Well, that was in 1919, too.